The Access Hour.
And welcome to the Access Hour. Tonight's show is about an unbroken circle that continues to widen. Please stay tuned for what I hope you will find to be a fascinating and moving story. I'm Gil Halstead. I'm a WART volunteer and monthly donor to this wonderful station. But the hat I wear tonight is as the chair of the board of directors of the Linda and Jean Farley Center for Peace, Justice, and Sustainability. This is a story about a labor of love that began a decade ago with a death and led to a dream that is still being realized. The center was founded 10 years ago on 40 acres of land just down the road outside Verona. It's home to a dozen organic farmers who raise vegetables in fields just below a forested hillside. The hillside has been transformed into a green cemetery, where anyone can lay down their weary bones at the end of their life and help ensure the land remains in its natural state in perpetuity. This show is a celebration of the center's 10th anniversary and the recent purchase of another 60 acres of land bordering the cemetery. I recently sat down with 8 people who all played key roles in shaping this dream and ensuring it continues to thrive. What follows is an edited version of that conversation. It begins with John Farley, the eldest son of Jean and Linda.
I can't believe 10 years have gone by already since this project kind of started. So that's pretty amazing. To talk about where it came from, first you have to remember the Farley Center is situated on a piece of land that my parents lived on for many, many years, for over 30 years. And my parents were quite active, you know, during those years. My father worked at the university, my mother practiced medicine. And their home became a place where they had many meetings, both for politically and socially progressive, conscious kind of stuff. And it was also a place that, you know, where they got their calmness and where they retreated to, and, you know, to get out of the hectic stuff of day to day, I guess. And as part of that, my dad took great pride in his tractor, and there were some farmers in Madison that, needed a little more land, and the community garden there offered them, and so my parents volunteered some of their land to be used for them to do a little bit more, and it turned out to be one of my father's favorite things, since, like I say, he liked that tractor, and he would make sure there was compost, and he would rototill every year for them, and they just, so for years and years, we had farmers out there. Well, you know, as my parents were getting older, when my dad turned 65, there's mandatory retirement at the University of Wisconsin. And when my dad turned 65, he retired from the university, but he and my mother both got even more, they were busier in their retirement than they were in their life, and they were pretty busy anyway, or in their work life, I guess I should say. And they got very active politically and, like I say, with socially progressive movements and so on. And especially, you know, as physicians who advocated heavily for single-payer health care across the United States. Well, I guess they would say the world. But anyway, they got very active and even busier. And but as they aged and got on, it became an issue about what we were going to do with the land, you know, when the time came to pass it on. None of the sons had any inkling that they would ever desire to live in Wisconsin. We all lived far away and we had full lives and everything. So none of us really had any use for the land if it was left to one of us. And selling it, none of us really needed the money badly either. We were all pretty well established in our own places. So my dad's dream was to kind of leave it as a conservation area if he could, you know, to keep it in its natural state. And unfortunately, you needed to have about 100 acres to donate your land to a conservatorship of some kind that would oversee, you know, maintaining it in its own condition. And we didn't have 100 acres. So that idea, although it was a good one, there was not really any good thing to do about it. Well, then, of course, and many of you have heard this story, or maybe for those of you listening, this is new, but my mother passed away. And so when my mother passed away, turns out my father and mother in their planning had always thought that they would leave their bodies to the medical school to be used in the medical training and stuff. And there was no plan B when it turned out the medical school had really no use for my mother's cadaver in this case. And so since there was no plan B, we're all scrambling around with what to do. And so the idea came, obviously, her favorite place in the world was this piece of land. So we decided that we would look into burying her there. And we did that. Sure enough, it turns out if you can bury a single family member on the property without any big permits, nothing fancy that you have to do. And so we went ahead and planned for her burial there. All the family obviously came up to Wisconsin from all their distant locales to be there for this. And it was a very loving week, I guess I would say. There were services, I'll be emotional a little bit. There were services for my parents in several locales, a big one that was held in combination with the Society of Friends Meeting Center. And there was a lot of celebration of my mother's life and of my father as well. And then we had the burial, and all the family participated. We dug the grave ourselves. We all fed things, you know, talked about our parents, and stood in silence. And the little grandkids and kids put stones and flowers and things they had gathered close by around the grave. So it was really a lovely time. It turned out to be, in fact, as you can hear in my voice, it's one of the more momentous moments in my life. It was really joyful. We celebrated my mother's life. And although we had great sorrow about her passing, you know, it was really a lovely time. We all bonded heavily there. Well, so obviously all the family was together. And once again, the topic of what do we do with the land came up. Well, it's a little different when your mom's buried out there, right? It's leaving it to somebody or selling it takes on a little different, even though, well, it's just a little different when your mom's buried there. So the idea came up of a natural cemetery. It was kind of, somebody had read an article, and it was kind of a new thing, idea, and it had been such a joy to us that my father, who's kind of a thinker in that kind of path, clomped right onto that idea and started investigating what it would take and what it would do. Well, it turns out there's some interesting things about being a cemetery. One of them is that once you become permitted as a cemetery, you will be maintained that way on into the future. In fact, the community that you're located in has to agree that they will maintain the cemetery, you know, if it should ever become defunct or not be run or whatever. And so that kind of solved the land conservatorship, even though we didn't have 100 acres. And then it also became apparent that not only would the cemetery, so my father dove right into writing up this big business plan. That was kind of one of the first things. He wrote up this big business plan and looking at the number of deaths in the area and all kinds of planning, you know, how you figure out how many people you can bury in a cemetery and all that kind of stuff. And it turned out that he felt like he could establish this Farley Center for Peace, Justice, and Sustainability, and for a major part of its funding, use the cemetery to cover that. And so that's kind of where the dream was born. That's kind of it right there. And my dad, with my mom gone, had some time on his hands and dove right in.
Next, We turned to Peter McKeever, who played a key role in ensuring the center was on solid legal ground.
I knew Linda and Jean from progressive events, political events in the community, Fighting Bob Fest and other things. I'd been out to the house a couple times. And I know when Jean ran for Congress years ago, I was involved in a very minor way in that kind of thing. And Jean eventually was talking about this idea, and he eventually came to me and said, asked if I could help. And there were sort of three major issues that had to be dealt with or resolved. The first one was creating the organization, creating the center, and securing tax-exempt status from the IRS. And so with help from people who were already involved, we gathered all kinds of data and information together and put together a large packet of information and sent it off to the IRS asking for a determination that this organization could be a 501c3. As I recall, that took, I don't know, 18 months or something before we got an answer. It took a while before we got an answer back. But eventually the answer was yes. And I was confident when we submitted it that we would get that answer, but it took a while to come back. With that, Gene went about gathering a board of directors and beginning to get the organization going. The second legal hurdle that we dealt with was, what's a cemetery? What do you have to do to have a cemetery in Wisconsin? Turns out there's very little that you have to do to have a cemetery. The only people that really care where people are buried is the State Historical Society. They like to know where people are buried for historical reasons. And there are some regulations about a cemetery. You're supposed to have essentially a trust fund, as John mentioned, a pot of money that could be used to maintain the thing, theoretically, in perpetuity. But you don't really need a permit, much of that, as I recall. We just sort of said, okay, we're a cemetery, and began to put it together. But we needed a conditional use permit from Dane County under the zoning laws. And this was where things got touchy. We had to apply for a conditional use permit because the land was not zoned for this kind of a use. And that meant that we had to provide notice to the neighborhood. And when we did that, there were some objections. There were folks who were worried that this was going to pollute the groundwater, ignoring the fact that wild animals were dying around the area all the time and doing what animals do when they die. They were worried that it was going to impact their property values. I remember talking to people that I know on a street in Madison that backs up on a cemetery, and comparing their property values to those across the street, only to discover that the property values backing up to the cemetery were higher than those across the street because they had the privacy of very quiet neighbors on the backside to be clear about it. It was open space, it was trees and birds and grass, and they knew nobody was going to live there. And we had to put a lot of information together about the soil, what the soil conditions were like. But we did a variety of that. And we pushed this through, eventually through the zoning department, and then we had to go to the zoning committee. As I recall, there was a hearing. And it turned out that, in my memory, one of the key supporters was a member of the county board who was normally very conservative in her politics. But in any case, she supported this. She thought this was a great idea. And that was really the key, I think. Once she said this was fine, nobody else objected. And the conditional use permit was eventually granted. Though that was a process that took, again, several months to get to that point. But subsequently, I had a friend pass away who was Jewish, and he wanted to be buried here. And that had the effect of opening up this cemetery to the Jewish community. Once he got buried there, it became very, I think, acceptable, particularly to the Jewish community, to use this facility for the purposes for which it was established. the underlying purposes of peace, justice, and sustainability were supported. Early on, we had done a lot of research and looked at what natural cemeteries were like in other parts of the country, what kind of models there were, and gathered a lot of that information. But eventually, it was up and running. And to this day, it still is. It's doing wonderful work.
The center is still thriving, but Melanie Zimmerman, who served on the center's first board of directors, has a vivid memory of the difficulties Gene Farley faced in convincing his neighbors to agree to let him start a cemetery and organic farm run by immigrants in their backyard.
We moved out here in 1984. It was November of 1984, and I think Gene and Linda beat us by maybe a year or two that they were here. So our kids grew up here, and they would skate on the Farley's Pond, and we would walk back through the pine trees in the back, and so we just knew them as being really great neighbors, both Gene and Linda. And we were aware when Linda got sick and then passed away, and I knew what a huge void that was going to leave in Gene's life, and so we tried to be good neighbors, you know, take him down a dish and stop in to see how he was doing. But then he had a neighborhood gathering. It was a cookout that he had after he'd come up with the idea for the Farley Center and the Natural Path Sanctuary. So I'm thinking maybe it was on the weekend, Saturday or Sunday, hot dogs, hamburgers, ice cream, the whole works. And surprisingly, because this is really rural out here, as you know, a lot of the neighbors showed up. Gene hopped up on a picnic table. I could just see this in my mind's eye still. He jumps up on this picnic table in his booming voice as people were finishing up eating, talking about the Farley Center and his vision and what he wanted to do and thanking everybody for showing up. And it said that he walked around to the different tables and chatted with them and talked about the idea. I want to say that then, that following Monday, whether this was a Saturday or a Sunday, I don't know, but the following Monday was the town board meeting for the town of Springdale. And the same neighbors who had shown up at this picnic and ate the hamburgers and ate the ice cream and drank the lemonade and all the rest of it were really, I thought, adamantly, and in some cases, I felt viciously voicing reasons why they did not want the Farley Center. They did not want the Natural Path Sanctuary. And I was surprised. I didn't know all of these people who had come. I didn't know all of the neighbors, but I knew most of them, and I was shocked. I was really shocked because I thought, Jesus, why didn't you talk to Gene yesterday or the Saturday or whatever it was? I mean, you went up there, you ate his food, you listened to his spiel. You thanked him, and you shook his hand, and you walked away, and now here you are at this town meeting like you've been blindsided. I was really shocked, and I was disappointed at this board meeting, and I was sitting with Gene at the time, and then after the shock and the kind of the anger, it dawned on me in a hurry that if I don't speak up, there is zero neighborhood support. Some of the neighbors were talking about these people that come and they farm and they put their blankets on the ground and they have these picnics and I'm so afraid I can't even go outside. And I thought, what the heck are you talking? What are you talking about? And I said, I've never associated these folks that have these gardens and these farms with criminal activity. Where are you guys coming from? And I felt like, honestly, Gil, I felt like if I didn't speak up, all there was just this rabid opposition because we don't want to pollute the groundwater and it's creepy to have a cemetery there. And these people, these criminals who are doing the gardening are just scaring us, and we don't feel like we can go outside. And I just thought, this isn't right. This isn't right. This isn't what it's about. This isn't what Gene and Linda were about. And so I just piped up, and I felt like I had to be pretty vocal because I was feeling like it was a fairly long voice. But I used to have this recurring nightmare where I would wake up and look out the backyard, and there would be towering McMansions in the field behind me. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, that would just be horrible. And the concept that that's never going to happen, because that land that's directly behind us is going to be in perpetuity part of the Farley Center and not going to be developed. Although, you know, they could ultimately end up putting a building back there or a learning center. And I mean, that's fine. But I don't have to wrestle with the prospect of there being McMansions behind us. And so from a very selfish perspective, I think it's wonderful.
Next, we'll hear from Omi Baldwin, a Navajo woman and retired UW staff member who served for several years as chair of the Farley Center Board. Omi got to know Gene and Linda Farley through medical students who studied under Gene at the medical school. She learned that Gene and Linda had run a health clinic on a Navajo reservation before they moved to Madison, and she eventually became close friends with them.
Some of the members of the Springdale Community Board were excellent. That, you know, they were supportive of us as and helped. It also helped. You know, was very focused. And Gene was very gentle, even though that some people were very against the Farley Center. But he was always very nice and very gentle. And I really appreciated that. I came across a little article that Gene had written. He said, the IRS requires that 25 acres for the natural burial ground. The Natural Past Sanctuary is a 501c13 entity to be separated in the independence from the Farley Center and the 501c3 entity. The Farley Center cannot own land which is leased to the Natural Past Sanctuary for $1 a year, but the NPS cannot be a business of its own. Therefore, NPS has its own board related to an independent of the Farley Center. And so what he talked about is breaking it up in a way to, you know, that there was a components to the Farley Center. One is the farm, and then there was the house and the facility around that was supposed to be the social justice center, where people who are, you know, burying their loved ones can also, you know, have whatever gathering they may want to do, and that be the real focus of peace and social justice, an extension. And the other one was Natural Past Sanctuary. That was 25 acres. And so, you know, and those were all at the planning stages. And, you know, so that's, you know, that was the evolving into that. And so it became very, very busy.
Yes, things did get very busy, very fast, once the groundwork for the center was laid. First in the fields below the house. It was Janet Parker who recruited and nurtured the farmers, who still today till the soil there and harvest the food marketed and sold throughout Dane County.
Linda and Gene, with the farmers and gardeners, they had already, I think, two decades of people gardening there at their land. Just with informal relationships and sort of in an overflow from the community gardens program in Madison. So 10 years ago when things got started, I was working for the community gardeners in town, and I often would hear from Madison community gardeners, where can I get more land? Many times that was from immigrant farmers, immigrant gardener scale in the community gardens, but people who, some from Southeast Asia, some from Latin America, who came from millennia of uninterrupted organic farming knowledge and had moved to this country with just enormous skill and knowledge and desire to feed their community, the community at large, in the ways that they knew how. But in many cases, recent immigrants may not have a spare $200,000 to buy land, buy a tractor, that may or may not be strong on the marketing side of how to sell the vegetables once they've been grown. So around the country 10 years ago, there were business incubators that were specifically organic vegetable farm incubators that were springing up in different places. And really, Dane County was a place that was waiting for a project like that to happen. So thank goodness for the Farley family and the relationships that they had already established. And then truly thank goodness for some of those core foundational farmers and gardeners who came in and made it happen and designed the program. But Yi Wai Tao, one of the initial board members, and then eventually one of the farmers too, she came in as a board person, helping to create the shape of the program, and then decided that she and her family would also take a farming plot and made a successful farm business. Juan Gonzalez, who was there from before the organization became a nonprofit, and had been farming, I think, since he was a little kid, and came with so much knowledge, and then gave so much of his time in the creation of the farm incubator. So a farm incubator is a place where farmers can come and be supported with the land, the equipment, and sometimes with training or know-how or marketing help. And that's really what we did. We all know that Wisconsin is, the farming in Wisconsin relies on immigrants from dairy farm workers who, tens of thousands of immigrants working in dairy, to Hmong vegetable farmers who are such a presence at every farmer's market that you go to in the state. So to be able to give an extra boost for new farm businesses to start was just, waiting to happen. Just a great project to get started. Something, it's in many ways a lot like the Green Cemetery, something that we needed one of nearby. So Gene and his son's vision, just amazing.
Why was it that you were, how and why was it that you were able to get the money to get this off the ground? I mean, the USDA grants that kind of launched the Farley Center, why were those there? Why was the USDA giving grants like those that the Farley Center ended up receiving?
Right. Thank you, Gil. So a business incubator, is something that, can often be good seed money. The money that we got, though, from USDA, those grants were specifically trying to right some of the wrongs of institutional racism that the USDA had been guilty of carrying out throughout the years of Jim Crow. So at the same time as there was redlining, campaigns of terror, all of the different pieces of that made up institutional racism in the wake of the Civil War and up until now, the USDA was one of those institutions that was carrying out huge bias. So when it came to farm loans, farm grants, support of all types, black farmers specifically, and then later women farmers and immigrant farmers, people of color farmers, were often discriminated against. And then there were a series of enormous lawsuits against the USDA. Two of them for $1 billion, class action lawsuits that were coming from black farmers, then later Latino farmers and women farmers. And so as the organization tried to turn the ship from their history of racism, as the USDA tried to change and really get out of the next lawsuits, they started putting money towards trying to support people of color farm businesses. And so that was specifically some of the grant money that the farmers at the Farley Center qualified for and got, and became some of the foundational funds for the center too.
One of the things that has changed from the beginning of this organization, specifically the farming aspect of it, Janet, from the time that you were there, is that, that the plan initially was that it would be an incubator that would train farmers who could then go off and find some land and be independent, and we could train more and more farmers there. That's turned out to not work quite as well, and I wonder, maybe you could comment a little bit about that, because the center has now shifted to calling the farming operation a collaborative farm rather than an incubator, although it still does function to a certain extent that way. We have, I think, 11 farmers there now, and it, occasionally people have been able to be trained there and find land, but it's a really difficult challenge for organic farmers. Can you comment about that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. It's 11 farm businesses that are there now, up from a small handful at the beginning. And yeah, exactly. What we found over the years, and what I think farm incubators around the country have found, is that it's not about getting capacity or knowledge in vegetable farming and then being able to launch out on your own. The reason that many vegetable farmers can't launch out on their own is that you need a huge amount of capital that you're never going to earn by selling vegetables, you know? So what people need is a long-term, a permanent home. And also they're building the soil, they're building relationships, they're working together in a collaborative that starts to look like villages all over the world where farming happens, not now until someone can go out and buy land elsewhere, but forever. So working together in a collaborative group, sharing tools, sharing ideas, sharing the joys and the struggles of farming, but most of all, sharing that land, and not going to leave from that land in the future, but going to stay. So it's beautiful. I mean, that's one of the reasons that the Green Cemetery, the National Planted Sanctuary piece, such a great land preservation strategy. The same thing with farming. We need to be farming some of these rich, fertile lands at the perimeter of our urban areas forever. We want to preserve the land and farm it forever. So it's so beautiful that the neighboring farm has now come into that collaborative, and that the farmers are able to farm on that, grow and expand onto that land. It's truly, I can't imagine a more vital mix of land uses, so many pressing needs that are filled at the Farley Center, and people from disparate backgrounds getting together, working together, and of course Jean and the Farley family core part of that, and also benefiting from it. It's just been a beautiful thing. I feel very lucky that I was part of it too.
Next, we turn to Kevin and Susan Corrado, who served as the center's first full-time staff. Getting the Green Cemetery off the ground, or should I say into the ground, they coordinated the delicate balance between the agricultural and social justice arm of the center's mission and the cemetery that helps fund it.
It's been touched upon by John Farley and Peter a bit in terms of the history, but one of the early, I think, influences for this dream was Jean and Linda attending a workshop that I conducted at the Religious Society of Friends, the Friends Meeting House, in 2008, because I was active with a statewide organization known as the Trust for Natural Legacies. And this was a group of individuals that were educating people around the community about the importance of the development of green cemeteries as one way to conserve land, to have some land designated to be a cemetery, which is protected in perpetuity. So I had learned a lot from the Trust for Natural Legacies, and I wanted to share my my information in. So in 2008, a year before Linda died, I did this workshop, and I had a conversation with Linda after that workshop, and I said, Linda, you know, I've been out to your house and your land several times because, as John indicated, they were very gracious hosts, and they had a lot of events there, including an annual event that the Friends had with the school-age children in terms of a cider press day and so forth. So I'd been there, I knew about their land, and I said, Linda, your place would be great for a natural burial ground and maybe to convert the house into a retreat center. And she said, Kevin, you know, I understand you have a passion and an interest in this, but my sons will really be the ones to decide, you know, what happens to our land and property when we die. And I said, I understand, Linda, but so a year later, Linda dies, as John talked about, and as the family retells the story of Linda's burial, and Jean tells about how, you know, they were trying to find out if they could bury her on their land, they really had a very, very powerful experience with that. And within a week of Linda's burial, Jean invited me to a meeting, which I believe Janet was invited to as well, as several other people were, because he and his son Tillman, who was staying in the area for a while, wanted to convene this group of people that they knew that had knowledge about farming, who had knowledge, some limited knowledge about natural burial grounds, and also some of their contacts through the Social Justice Center. Linda and Jean have been generous supporters of the Social Justice Center on Lily Street in Madison. So Jean drew upon his network, had this planning meeting with Tillman, and I was there at the first meeting, and I was sort of assigned to help coordinate a group of individuals that could begin to envision what's involved with creating a natural burial ground. So I drew upon my contacts with the Trust for Natural Legacies and some people connected with the Friends meeting and so forth. And we were one of the planning groups, so to speak. And it was really the agriculture, the farming component that really got developed quickly and first of all. So in 2009, we have a planning group. We were meeting. It wasn't until 2011 that the cemetery had gone through the process that Peter spoke of, and we got approval through the county and through the town of Springdale, and we were able to be operational after the surveying was done and so forth in approximately June of 2011. So that's the 10th anniversary that we're celebrating later this year as well. So that gives you a little additional history and how I got involved. Also, the other thing I wanted to share was that Susan and I knew Jean and Linda from the community because of their active involvement in so many different things and because we were active with the Friends meeting. Jean and Linda were very active and respected individuals there as well. So we had even talked about how if there was a couple in the community that we would like to be like, you know, sort of like, how could we ever be like Jean and Linda? They were just such amazing individuals and touched so many people's lives in so many different ways. And so we were basically honored in many ways for Jean to invite us to live and be resident staff there in 2011 because we had so much respect and admiration for the work that Linda and Jean had done in their professional lives and their personal lives. And so it was just a real honor to be involved in the ways that we were and to be the first resident staff. Clearly challenging. It's difficult to live and work in the same place and to always be available, but we thought we needed to be available when people inquired about the cemetery. You can't just say, come back on Monday morning. They needed things right away, and so it was challenging, but we think we helped lay the groundwork, no pun intended, but I did enjoy digging graves, quite honestly. It was physical labor, you could see the fruits of your labor, and you had a special connection with the land and the families who worked along. There were families who dug the graves with me, and most of the families filled in the graves. But it was just, I got a lot out of the experience, and I hopefully contributed some as well. But it was just very powerful in lots of different ways. And there's not enough time for me to tell all of my stories, but hopefully that gives you a little sense.
Before I turn to Susan, though, Kevin, I do want to ask you to at least tell us maybe one anecdote. It's interesting to me to think about how you ended up being a cemetery caretaker or director. Is that something that you thought about doing at any other time in your life? I mean, did you was this like a lifelong ambition, and finally?
Well, I wasn't expecting that question. But so professionally, I was a hospital social worker. I also knew Gene and Linda from University Hospital, where I worked for 24 and a half years. And I knew Steve from Friends Meeting. And there was a time, I think it was in my early to mid-50s, thinking I want to make a career change. And so I made an inquiry about what did I need to do to become a funeral director? Because when I was an undergraduate in social work in the 70s, one of our guest speakers at one of the classes, I think it was our aging and social work class, and he was a social worker who also lived up in the Twin Cities and was a funeral director. And so I was intrigued by that combination. And he did, I think, some grief counseling work as well as operating the funeral home. So I learned quickly that I didn't want to go back to school, to mortuary science school, and do the necessary training to get my funeral director's license. But when I learned more about the Trust for Natural Legacies and that the Wiccan community in western central Wisconsin was developing a natural cemetery, I was intrigued, and I had learned about this from Reverend Selena Fox, who was involved with the Wiccan community developing their cemetery, which became operational in 2010, the year before Natural Past Sanctuary. But I learned from these folks, and I realized that I could use a lot of my social work skills working with families at time of death and grief. I had worked on the trauma unit at University Hospital, had a lot of experience working with families. And so in some ways, I saw it as a progression of professional career and skills and interests, and I'd never really thought about being a grave digger per se, but I think I was much more than that, it was an aspect that I enjoyed it. But we used a lot of volunteers and so forth, and it was just very rewarding.
Well, if there's one story that sticks out in terms of dealing with families that once the sanctuary became operational, really became a cemetery, just give us one.
Okay. One very powerful story early on was a couple that had a stillbirth, and I knew them from the community. They knew that I was at the Farley Center, and they called me up and they said, Kevin, actually, before the stillbirth happened, they were anticipating it was going to happen. They had a medical background, and they knew that things were not looking good. And when they came out to see the land, one of the things that the woman said to me is, Kevin, we would be comforted knowing that this particular part of the meadow would be a child and infant section. I said, you know, we've never thought in terms of having different sections to the cemetery. We see everyone equal in life and death. We didn't want there to be a rich person section and a poor person and a Jewish section and a Catholic, whatever. But I said, this is an intriguing question that we've never really thought about. So I took it back to Gene and Susan. We didn't have a lot of time to make this decision. But we said, we could make this a relatively small section. And it would be very powerful and meaningful to this family and maybe to future families. And so they influenced us early on to sort of make that designation that that portion of the meadow area would be a child and infant section. And then they wanted to dig the grave with me. And we had to use the pickaxe to break up the sandstone and so forth because it was an area that wasn't all soil. And But they worked with me over a period of a couple of days, and maybe a couple of weeks after they had the burial and lowered their infant in a basket into the grave that they had prepared, they visited a couple of weeks later and they said, "Kevin, we didn't realize how cathartic this whole experience would be, preparing the grave, selecting the site, working with you, working with the other staff." And so that was one of the most powerful experiences.
And now some thoughts from Kevin's partner, Susan Corrado.
I am a nurse by background and have been working in the Allied Drive neighborhood and have been instrumental in developing a nonprofit there. And actually, Linda had volunteered for one of our programs on a monthly basis. And when Kevin had expressed interest in the natural burial idea, he drew me in, basically. And because we were married, I followed him. But it occurred to me that this was a big undertaking. I mean, this was a big dream, vision, and a lot of work. Janet Parker was already galloping along with the development of the Farm Incubator Program, but the whole idea of natural burial ground was really very novel. And so I was at a time in my life where I was ready to make a career change. And with my limited experience with developing a nonprofit, and also I think one of my strengths is organizational skills, I said, "I think I can do it." And so Jean invited us, and it was an amazing experience. I mean, it was very powerful to live there, to have people coming and sharing their life stories around people who died, meeting farmers from other countries. It was just a beautiful setting. And the whole experience was just life-changing, actually, and I loved it. It was very demanding, I will say that. But what was so amazing was that we were treading on new territory. None of us really had a lot of experience in any of this, but we pulled together. The board was terrific, the staff, the volunteers. I mean, it just became a community enterprise. And that's what I think is so beautiful. And I think it really did justice to Jean's vision.
I want to ask you, Susan, you were involved in having to deal with balancing these two major actually there are three functions of the center, but and you had to deal with sort of balancing all three of those. The Kevin Corrado was managing the cemetery. You had to have some involvement in that and somehow balance what was going on the fields below with the farmers and with the social justice aspect of that. It's kind of a general question, but I mean, how did you figure out how to coordinate all of that?
Well, first of all, Jean was very opposed to the idea of the term director, and we were facilitators. So that really was our role, actually. And I think that actually that's exactly how it all worked out, was because I was able to facilitate a lot of different information and work that a lot of different people were doing, and just sort of pulled it together so that we had an organizational format. But it really was a joint effort, is how I did it.
Beyond broken.
And finally, we turn to Steve Ventura, now a retired soil science professor at UW-Madison, and until last year, the chair of the board of the Green Cemetery, the Natural Path Sanctuary.
I'll take you back to when I originally met the Farleys, which was in the early 90s, through my wife's Quaker connections. She was starting a fiddlehead fern business and needed a temporary place to plant some of those ferns until she had a property to put them on. That temporary place is still a beautiful entrance to the Natural Path Sanctuary. You can come out and see the Margaret ferns anytime you want. In getting NPS started, I'll briefly echo what Peter McKeever said. There were challenges at the county and the town board meetings. In particular, there were a few vocal neighbors that raised three issues. Peter mentioned two of them, the notion of potential groundwater contamination and the potential diminution of property values. Those arguments were very easily allayed. I talked to some of my colleagues in the Wisconsin Geological Natural History Survey and looked at the well depth in the area and so forth. Absolutely no concern. You know, that's land where farmers have been spreading manure for 100 years and the wells are still just fine. I also, to amplify Peter's anecdote about his neighbors in Madison, found several academic articles suggesting that a permanently protected open space associated with cemeteries is an asset to property values. The third issue that was raised was what happens when all those bones come up from these shallow graves? In a green cemetery, the idea is to place a body 2.5 to 3 feet deep, where there's still activity in the soil that will help decompose the body. It only took a little bit of research and talking to a few people at the Green Burial Council to, you know, say definitively, you do not have to worry about this. So I think maybe it was just this expert soil scientist and this expert lawyer at the back of the Springdale town meeting wisely nodding our heads. We got the board approval. In terms of challenges, I think that getting the word out there, building the clientele was one of the early challenges. Another challenge that has been a bit alleviated with Shed Farley as the director was overcoming Gene Farley's instinct to just let everything go completely wild without any vegetation management. We had lots and lots of discussions about how people may not find it very appealing to go into a green cemetery if it's overrun with prickly ash and bramble and multiflora rose and garlic mustard and other things that they would find objectionable. I think probably the most interesting challenge, and this is largely attributed to Gene in overcoming, is getting the right business model. It's expensive to keep land in conservation practices. There's annual taxes, there's property upkeep, and his idea of using a not-for-profit cemetery to generate revenue for a non-profit community organization really was unique and, to me, inspiring. It's part of the reason why I stuck with it and really wanted to make it work. This new land that has been acquired recently, that we'll be dedicating officially in a few weeks, provides opportunities, as Janet mentioned, for expanding the farm operation, for potentially expanding the Green Cemetery at some point. We will fill up what we have in a few decades. And it is going to be a challenge as well, figuring out how to manage a very large chunk of land with a very small staff, in keeping with the spirit of the Farley Center, using to the extent possible non-chemical means of growing food and of managing the natural areas over such a large acreage is clearly going to require some careful thought and effort. One other challenge in the Green Cemetery that I'll mention is that there are places on this property where getting a hole 3 feet deep can be very challenging. One of the reasons, another reason that I stuck with it is because it was a huge educational opportunity for the students that I work with. So we came out and mapped all the places where there is shallow soil over fractured bedrock. I suspect those maps are still in use as people think about where they're going to be able to dig down in order to place their loved ones.
Kevin Corrado has these thoughts about potential future projects at the Farley Center.
I'd love to see an opportunity for some people who say, hey, can I plant a tree at my dad's grave? To say, no, we are developing an arboretum, a portion of that new land, which will provide a buffer and so forth. Won't be necessarily burial ground, will not necessarily be farming. It could be something else, such as an arboretum of some sort, this unique species that... I also think the Farley Center has been enriched by having farmers from various ethnic and cultural backgrounds. And I'd love to see us enhance that notion of multicultural, that yes, Jewish practices are common to do a natural burial, as it's true for the Muslim people of the Islamic faith as well. And that this, the naturopath sanctuary could use the burial practices of various faith traditions and ethnic practices as a teaching model for other communities so that enhance the educational opportunities to do this multicultural learning, not only with regard to growing food and the different practices that various farmers provide in collaboration, but also to enhance the opportunities for in depth for us to learn about other people who have different backgrounds, Native American traditions. So I'd like to expand that collaboration and educational component, and this new land could maybe be used in some creative way along those lines as well.
And Steve Ventura has this final invitation to listeners to consider volunteering at the center as it continues to grow.
It's a beautiful piece of property that has really, to a substantial extent, relied on volunteers and people just interested in putting in time and effort. The board of both Farley Center and Naturopath Sanctuary do it out of a love for that land and the ideas that it represents. And if anyone out in radio land is interested, we're not that hard to find. We will find ways to get you engaged.
That was Steve Ventura. I'm Gil Halstead. Thanks for listening to the show. And as Steve said, do get in touch with us at thefarleycenter.org or on Facebook or Instagram.
You've been listening to The Access Hour. The views expressed on The Access Hour do not necessarily represent those of the station's board of directors, staff, or programmers. Please remember that this show relies on your ideas. You can submit your idea by clicking on Sign Up to Host an Access Hour in the WORT website. The Access Hour is anything you want it to be.
Wurtstock is coming to Warner Park on Sunday, September 12th. Sponsored by Union Cab, MG&E Foundation, Summit Credit Union, Five Nines, Madison Essentials, and the Willie Street Co-op.
Evolving from the WORT Block Party, Wurtstock is a musical celebration of community radio, now in the beautiful oak-lined landscape of Warner